So we are continuing our journey through the life of Jesus each week, if you've been for some time now. And we have a long ways to go. But today we come to a story of an encounter, actually an interrupted encounter that Jesus had. It became two encounters. And we're going to look at this story today, and we're going to look at two versions of it. We're going to look at Mark's version of the story and Luke's version of the story. Sometimes we'll pick one or another when the story is told in multiple places. But today, the story is so well told by both of them, that we're going to mash them together. There are just certain things that Mark says about today's story that we don't want to overlook his wording. There's things that Luke says about today's story that we don't want to overlook that wording. And so we're going to take both of them, and we're literally going to mash them by jumping from one passage to the other. Like sometimes one verse at a time will flip back and forth. It'd be very hard to follow along. I apologize. The good news is our verses are always on the screen, so that can make it easier to follow along as we move between Mark and Luke today for today's story. Now, today's story takes place right after another story that we saw 3 weeks ago. We don't always stay chronologically true to the stories. On major events we will, but sometimes we let the story's not always clear on chronology. Sometimes it is. We do know that today's story takes place right after the story where Jesus healed the demon-possessed man. Remember that story a couple weeks back? Whole herd of pigs were affected. It was crazy. Well, in that story, the people of that community and those communities asked Jesus to get back in the boat with his disciples and head on the other side of the lake or the Sea of Galilee because they were kind of shook by his power and they weren't ready for that. Now, the good news is he left the man who he healed, stayed behind, and he went ahead and, at Jesus' request, spread the message of Jesus all over the 10 cities of that region. And someday, we've not seen this yet, but someday Jesus will come back to that region and have a great ministry there because the people are ready for him later like they are not at that time. Partly because of Jesus helping this man and the man spreading the message until Jesus came back once again. And that's a great lesson for all of us about our call to spread the good news of Jesus. But anyhow, at the people's request at this time, they got back into their boat and they left. And that brings us to today's story. Mark chapter 5 and verse 21 is where we will begin. It says, Jesus got into the boat again, and he went back to the other side of the lake, where a large crowd gathered around him on the shore. People were waiting for him there because people had seen him do miracles there before, and they are wanting him back. There are new miracles. There are new people that need healing. There are new people with questions to ask the teacher. They are ready for him to show up. It's like a celebrity arriving on shore. And as soon as he gets off the boat, boom, there's a crowd. Verse 22 tells us that a leader of the local synagogue, whose name was Jairus, arrived. Now, he's there for a specific reason we will see, but I think it's worth noting that he's mentioned here. He would also be somewhat of a local, you know, he's a public figure. He's the synagogue leader, so people know who he is, and he's just showing up with the rest of the crowd. A lot of times, the local religious leaders weren't always super friendly with Jesus. Not that all of them felt that way, but we've seen some of the rough encounters before. You never know what anyone thinks. Jairus seems to be more open, or maybe it's circumstantial. Either way, it's significant that he is there on the shore to welcome Jesus among the crowd. But why is he there? Well, Luke chapter 8, verse 42 tells us that his only daughter, who was about 12 years old, was dying. Can you imagine, mom and dad, can you imagine that? How horrible. What a horrible thing. His 12-year-old girl. She's not sick. Sick is bad. When our kids are sick, we almost wish we were sick for them. It's hard to see them struggle. We might worry that the worst could happen. This is a girl who is not sick. She is dying. It's just a matter of when. And this man is grief-stricken. Mark 5:22 says that when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet, fervently pleading with him. My little daughter is dying, he said. Please come and lay your hands on her. Heal her so she can live. Jairus has taken a chance to leave her bedside, knowing that he might not be there when she dies because she's dying. And who wants to leave and not be there for her final moments? His only daughter. little girl. But he says, I'm going to take a chance and go because I'm hoping for a miracle. So he forget composure, forget you know, dignity. He just falls before Jesus, and perhaps he has to keep his composure at home, be strong for the family. But right here in the sight of the shore, he just falls down before Jesus, and he fervently says, please, my little girl needs a miracle. Verse 24 says, Jesus went with him, and all the people followed, crowding around him. I imagine that the people are crowding as he goes because they want him to heal this girl whose family they know, but also because they just want to see a miracle. That's the big deal. And so they're crowding, and can you imagine how that would slow the journey to Jairus' house with a crowd thronging around? Have you ever moved through a crowd? You ever leave a big event where there's lots of people? It just makes everything slower. Maybe you've been to a ball game or a concert or Disney or any place where you're just like, okay, trying to get out there. We're all bottlenecking and it's just moving slower. And the crowd is just everywhere pressing around Jesus. They want to be near him, talk as they go. This man just wants Jesus to get to his house because his 12-year-old girl needs a miracle. And he hopes it's not too late. But the whole crowd's going with and they're slowly moving that direction. In Mark chapter 5, in verse 25, it says that a woman in the crowd had suffered for 12 years with constant bleeding. Not just periodic bleeding, like women could understand, but 12 years of constant bleeding, constantly. Can you imagine the anemia that would come from that and all the health problems? Is she married? Is she not? Does she have a family? I don't know her situation, but she's 12 years. By the way, that's as long as Jairus' dying daughter's been alive. How long is 12 years? I think it depends on who you ask. How long time is usually measured by the circumstance. Isn't that right? You ever try to do a plank to work out your core for 5 minutes? A 5-minute plank is like an eternity, right? Like time never ends. But you know, you're watching a good movie and 45 minutes goes by just like that. How long is 12 years? Well, to a woman who's had 12 years of constant bleeding and all the problems that has brought her, 12 years is forever. For a father whose only daughter is dying, her 12 years have been way, way too short. And here, this woman is in the crowd and she is desperate. It says in verse 26 that she had suffered a great deal from many doctors. And over the years, she had spent everything she had to pay them. But she had gotten no better. In fact, she had gotten worse. Now, isn't that frustrating? To go all those years. I don't know if she has a family that supports her, or she has work she can do or whatever she can do to come up with any money. But whatever she's had come in, she sends it out. Pays the doctors, and over time, she's just broke, and she's not any better. In fact, she's financially worse, and she's physically worse. How frustrating and hopeless that must feel. It says in verse 27 that she had heard about Jesus, so she came up behind him through the crowd and touched his robe. Now we need to talk about this, because this woman, even being in the crowd, is kind of an ordeal, because you see, she's bleeding, and it was customary. It was a part of their religious rituals and beliefs back then. When a woman was bleeding, she's supposed to be considered unclean ceremonially. That's part of their traditions, that she would be ceremonially unclean. I don't mean she feels unclean, like she's bleeding, so she kind of feels gross that day. That's all I'm talking about. I'm talking about ceremonially, she's unclean and supposed to stay away from public until that's over and until she purifies herself. And if anyone would come in contact with someone who's bleeding like that, well, they would be unclean until the evening and have to do certain rituals. It's just a whole ordeal by their traditions and customs that seem weird to us today, perhaps. For sure, they seem weird to us. But she's had 12 years of this, and so does she go in public? People might not want to deal with her because of the implications in their culture. Is she struggling? Do people help her do certain business and who are kind of just good-hearted people that work around others' apprehension because of her condition to be in public in a place where contact would happen? I don't know. But she comes through the crowd today. Now, that means a whole lot of people are becoming unclean today. And why would she do that? Because I don't think she cares. She's desperate. And here's the thing. Let's be honest. A crowd is sometimes a great way to be anonymous. Can we be real? Like, it's easy to get lost in a crowd. It's much harder to get unnoticed in a small gathering. It's like I've gone on vacation over the years with the family, and we've gone to other churches when we're traveling on a Sunday, and we've walked into some small churches. And when you walk into a small church, you don't go unnoticed. Like, oh, visitors, how are you? And everyone's going to find out what your story is, right? We've gone to large places, and no one even knows we're there. Because you can be alone, and you can actually be lonely sometimes in a crowd, right? It's just easy to blend in. And she's like, I'll just get lost in the crowd because I got to get to Jesus. And if anyone has a problem with that, hopefully they won't, because they might. But she's just got to get to Jesus. And so she gets there to touch his robe. It says in verse 27, for 28, for she thought to herself, if I can just touch his robe, I will be healed. She thinks to herself, all I got to do is touch his robe. That's all. I don't have to stop him, have a conversation. She probably doesn't want that kind of attention in her situation. She just wants a miracle. So instead of stopping him and asking, I'll just touch his robe and maybe that one thing will change everything for me. And so she does so. Of course, that's dangerous. People will be mad she's there. She's going to make Jesus to be ceremonially unclean before he goes to the synagogue leader's house to heal his daughter. I mean, this is a bad time. But she thinks, I just need healing. And I believe that he can heal me. It says in verse 29 that immediately the bleeding stopped and she could feel in her body that she had been healed of her terrible condition. Now, think about that. She touches his robe and instantly she feels change. Like what's been happening to her for the last 12 years is not normal, but it has become her normal. But in this moment, it's no longer her normal, and she's healed. And she feels this terrible condition has been fixed. And I wonder if she just is just shocked, if she gasps, if she puts her hands over her mouth or pulls back, and just something changed in that moment. Look what happens in Luke 8:45. It says, "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. "Who touched me?" Everyone denied it. And Peter said, "Master, this whole crowd is pressing up against you." That's just kind of a funny little passage to me. Jesus like stops and is like, okay, who touched me? And everyone around him who's been bumping against him, because it's a big crowded place, and they're all thinking, oh, I probably bumped into him several times. But he seems a little concerned by it, so I'm not going to admit it. Not me, you know. And Peter, leave it to Peter. Peter's always the one to speak up. If you've not gotten to know Peter yet, wait for the weeks to come. Peter's the one that's going to say the thing that no one else is going to say. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's not good, but Peter will talk. And Peter's like, listen, Master, this whole crowd's pressing against you. What do you mean who touched you? Like 85 of us touched you, man. What are you talking about? And so, but verse 46, but Jesus said, now someone deliberately touched me, for I felt healing power go out from me. Jesus is like, this is not just some accident. I felt something happen. Just the way the woman felt her body be healed when she touched his robe, Jesus also felt something happen. And he calls attention to it. Verse 47 tells us that when the woman realized that she could not stay hidden, she began to tremble, and she fell on her knees in front of him. Now, why was she trembling? Maybe because she was afraid that someone would say she did something wrong, coming here unclean and touching me. I mean, she made a whole scene for herself. Maybe she thought she didn't get permission. Maybe she just was shy and didn't want the exposure. That's why she didn't ask him for a miracle. Or maybe she's trembling because she knows something amazing has just happened and she's excited about it, but she can't believe it. And she's trembling for joy and overwhelm. But she's shaking and thinking, oh my goodness, something happened. It says the whole crowd heard her explain why she had touched him and that she had been immediately healed. And all of a sudden, what was supposed to be a private moment on Jesus' way to another place has become a public scene. In Mark 5 and verse 34, it says, and Jesus said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Your suffering is over. Wow. That's beautiful. So we saw that last week when that woman came into the house of Simon the Pharisee and greeted Jesus. And everyone knew she was an immoral woman in the city in her case. But Jesus said to her, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. And here in this story, Jesus looks at this woman and says, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Your suffering is over. What beautiful words. I can only imagine Jairus is standing there trying to get his own daughter's miracle. And he hears Jesus say to this other woman, whose dad isn't there to represent her, Jesus says to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Your suffering is over. And as I read that part of the story and I think of this lady's miracle, I can't help but wonder, why does Jesus act like he didn't know who touched him? Like he didn't know what happened? We've watched Jesus, haven't we, the last few weeks? He can like read people's thoughts. Certainly he's not really that shocked. Why does he make a big deal about who touched him? Why does he kind of call her forward and point her out and make sure she comes forward in that moment? Well, let me offer you a couple reasons. I don't know. Maybe you'll pick the one you like. Maybe he did it to declare her clean because, again, people knew her in that community and she hasn't been clean. But now, because everyone's watching, that whole crowd is there and he stops. Now everyone's going to know she's fine now. Let's just kind of clear things up for her going forward while everyone's paying attention. Maybe that's why he did it. Maybe he made a deal to encourage her that she was okay. Because maybe she would have felt bad, like, hey, I got my miracle, but I didn't ask. And is it permanent or temporary? What's going on? He wants her to know, hey, it's okay. You did good. Your faith, hey, your suffering is over. Maybe he did it because he wanted to point out her faith. Jesus has been known to do that. He said at other times to, like, the Roman centurion we met a few weeks ago or other people, hey, look at this person's amazing faith. Perhaps he wants to just show off her faith to the town. I don't know if any of those reasons are true. Maybe all of those reasons are true. Can I offer you one more reason, maybe? Perhaps he did it to show that when unclean people come to Jesus, it doesn't make him unclean. They end up becoming clean. That there's a lot of people who say, oh, you're not the kind of person I want near me, not you, because of this reason or that reason. And I just think that you're just going to just stay away. And Jesus says, that's not how I see anybody. That's not how I see anybody in the world, no matter what the reason you would label. Jesus, you come to me. It doesn't soil me. It doesn't ruin me. But it can change everything for you. Come to me. So he makes a big deal. Anyhow, while all this is happening, in Luke chapter 8, verse 49, says that while Jesus was still speaking to her, a messenger arrived from the house of Jairus, the leader of the synagogue. He told him, your daughter is dead. There's no use troubling the teacher now. I can only imagine how this whole moment has gone as Jairus is trying to get Jesus to his house and he's feeling urgent. The crowd is slowing him down. Then Jesus stops and says, who touched me? And Jairus turns around and he looks around and says, what's going on here? And this woman comes forward. Maybe Jairus has gotten caught up in the moment of her story because it's such a big scene. But then at some point he turns back and he sees from the direction of his house, he sees one of his people from his house walking that way. And that person shouldn't be coming his way. He should be at the house. That's not good. That's not a good sign. And he can see from the man's face who's approaching him that it's not good news. And perhaps Jared's in his heart is already saying, oh, no, 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 not this. Don't say it. Don't say it. And the man says to him, I'm sorry. It's too late. You missed it. You weren't there. But your daughter died. Imagine Jairus is just the sadness that sweeps over him as his head hangs. And the man says to him, there's no use to trouble the teacher anymore. Well, Jairus was glad to go trouble the teacher on the side of the seashore because he had a trouble of his own and he wanted a miracle. The same way that the woman who's been bleeding for 12 years of her own was willing to trouble the teacher because she needed a miracle. But right now the man says to Jairus, it's no point in troubling him any further because it's too late now. She's died. It's terrible. Verse 50 tells us, but when Jesus heard what had happened, he said to Jairus, don't be afraid. Just have faith, and she will be healed. What do you mean healed? Healing is what happens before she dies. He wanted you to heal her. It's not your fault. It's too late now. What do you mean healed? He says, yeah, don't worry. Don't be afraid. Just have faith. Now, I was reading the story, and we were preparing this message even weeks ago. We tried to stay well ahead on our Sunday preparation as a team. And as I was working on this one, made a statement that I wanted to make today, and I just want to say this today. I have to believe that someone needs to hear what I'm going to say next. And I thought this for weeks, that God knows who is going to be here and what's going on, and someone needs to hear this, whether you're in person or watching online or watching later. But for whoever needs to know, I want you to hear these words. Nothing is over until Jesus says it is. And again, I don't know who needs that today, but someone needs to hear that. Nothing's over until Jesus says it is. That's what faith is all about. Faith is saying that there comes a time when a door is closed. We're like, okay, now faith calls me to accept the will of God when it's not my will, and that's a whole battle in itself. But faith before that calls me to come to him and say, God, I believe you can. I'm asking that you will. And that's another kind of faith. And sometimes we think, oh, it's just too late now. It's too late. But nothing's over until it's over. Nothing's over until Jesus says it is. And for someone today, that's what you need to know. And Jesus says, don't worry about it. She'll be okay. In Luke 8, verse 51, it says, when they arrived at the house, Jesus would not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, James, and the little girl's father and mother. So all that crowd that has come with him from the seaside, Jesus says, y'all stay out here in the street. You can't come in the house. But Jesus has his own disciples that follow him. We saw he has 12 that's often with him. There's 72 others we've met recently. There's a whole bunch of people. He always has these 12 plus a bunch of other women that we've seen named before in his entourage. But Jesus can't bring everyone into that house, and so he brings three of them, Peter, John, and James. And if you're going to pay attention over the next many weeks, you're going to see there are other stories upcoming where Jesus brings Peter, John, and James to special access points that none of his other disciples get to go to. Just those three. Maybe because he can only bring so many. And he decides to pour a little bit more, to coach them up a little bit more, to prepare them a little bit more for what's coming next. Why those three? I don't know. Maybe because they needed it more. Peter was a hothead and talked a lot, and James and John were the sons of thunder. He's like, you guys need more of me. You guys come with me. Or maybe because they were leaders in developing, and he saw the chance for them to lead, and he wants to pour into them. Or maybe both. But Jesus is going to several times bring these three deeper into his ministry than any of the other disciples. And that's going to show up again. And even after Jesus dies on the cross, rises again, and returns to glory, you'll see stories where Peter, later in his life, is in situations just like this one. And I can't help but think he remembers back to being a younger man and walking with Jesus into these kinds of moments. And so, Jesus says, let's go in the house. The mom has probably rushed out the door to hug her husband, to grieve together when he got back home. The two of them, plus Jesus, plus these three disciples, walk inside. Verse 52 says, the house was filled with people, weeping and wailing. But Jesus said, stop the weeping. She isn't dead. She's only asleep. Now, that's not true. We saw already, and we're going to see again, she was dead. Like, why is Jesus fibbing here? Can we say lying? Is that okay? No, why is he saying that? Like, what's he talking about here? And why is he saying, stop the weeping? Like, I mean, can't you cry? Or is he just trying to calm them down, like, it's okay, don't cry? Well, I think that's possible, but I think you need to understand the culture to appreciate the story. In that time, people would show up to someone's house when someone was dying or had died, and they would actually weep and wail out loud as a custom. There were actually people that would be called wailers that would come to scenes like this and wail. And that's weird to you and me, But we have our own customs. We have our own customs. Like when someone passes away, we send flowers, or we send something else in lieu of flowers, or we will show up into a special building where a service is being held, and we will sign a guest book, and we'll send in a long line of people to show final respects or to comfort the survivors who are grieving, because those are our customs when someone dies. And in that culture, one of the customs was to show up at the house and to express the outward grief by weeping and wailing with the family over their loss. And Jesus walks in and says, hey, stop it. Stop the weeping. She's not dead. She's only asleep. But the crowd laughed at him because they all knew that she had died. These are the wailers. Mom and dad aren't laughing. People who are deeply personally hurting are going to go from weeping to laughing. They might go from weeping to keep weeping or weeping to stop in shock at those words. But the wailers, they just kind of flip a switch and they go from wailing to laughing at him. They're like, what is he talking about? Who's this guy showing up? What does he know? We've been here. We know what happened. Who's this Yahoo? It says in Mark 5, verse 40, that it says, but Jesus made them all leave. He's like, get out. Guys, go out in the street with the other crowd that came here with me. Just go outside. He took the girl's father and his mother, and his three disciples into the room where the girl was lying. Can you picture this? They now walk into the room by themselves, the six of them. And dad's back for the first time. He left her bedside while she was dying, and he comes back to see her lifeless body there. How terrible of a moment it would be for anyone. Verse Luke 8:54 says, then Jesus took her by the hand and said in a loud voice, my child, get up. That seems kind of intense, doesn't it? Like she's been, not that she's dead, so that seems weird, but she's also been ill and laying in bed. Like, how about sit up or roll over? He's like, my child, he's like talking to like when you're telling your kids to get out of bed because they're late for school. You know, my child, get up, he says. And at that moment, her life returned. Notice that she had passed away. She had died. At that moment, her life returned. And she immediately stood up. Wow. And Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Verse 56 tells us her parents were overwhelmed, but Jesus insisted that they not tell anyone what had happened. It's weird, isn't it? Like, he just walked in the house and said, oh, she's not really dead. She's asleep. Not true, Jesus. And then he's like, Mom and Dad, let's go with that story. Let's not tell him what really went down here. It's kind of one of those situation ethics questions. Is it okay to distort the truth if it's for a greater good? Why would Jesus distort this, what happened? Is it because he doesn't want fame? Because in times past, he would say, don't tell my miracles because I don't want the crowd to mob me. Well, it's kind of late for that. The crowd's already mobbing him outside. It's not like Jesus was always shy about his miracles. Sometimes he would publicly do them. That's why the crowd was out there. They've seen miracles before. By the way, everyone knows a miracle just happened in this house. Even if they passed off the story that she was just sleeping and sick, she was sick and now she's better, so there's another miracle. Why not tell the whole story? I mean, Jesus was on his way here when he made a woman who was trying to be anonymous come to the front and expose her healing by touching his robe. Why is he all of a sudden saying, let's not tell this story to everybody? Let's keep her revival from death a secret. I don't know. I think maybe one reason is because she's a 12-year-old girl who does not need that kind of pressure, that kind of fame. You know, so that make her near-death experience to be someone's book or movie, you know? Let her be a little girl. You know, there's a story coming up that we've not gotten to yet, but some of you already know it, that a man named Lazarus who had died, it was dead longer than that, was resurrected by Jesus, and it brought Lazarus celebrity status, both good and bad. People who wanted to kill Jesus wanted to kill Lazarus because his revival of life brought Jesus, credential. So they wanted him dead too. So Jesus is like, this little girl doesn't need a show, right? Maybe that's why he's doing it. Like, just leave her alone. Let her be a little girl. She died, brought her back. Let's tell everyone she was really sick. Let's leave it there. I don't know if that's the reason, but it makes sense to me. You can speculate as well. But that's where the story ends. That's where our story ends today. Before we're done, I want to say this to you. In today's encounters, we found two people with troubles and problems who both turned to Jesus with the hopes that he could make a difference. They could have decided that it wasn't worth bothering him over, that maybe they were too unimportant, or maybe that their problem was just too unfixable. Have you ever been there before where you had a problem and you didn't bother? Maybe you didn't even think to pray because you were so distracted by your problem. Or maybe if you ever had a situation where you felt embarrassed to pray, you're like, this is not that big of a deal. I don't know if anyone's ever felt that way. I can tell you, I have at times thought the thing that's bothering me, I don't know how to make a big, I feel bad praying about it because there are worse problems in the world than my problems, right? Like you feel guilty saying, hey God, you know, of all the bad things in the world, here's what I'm upset about. Deal with my situation. But then that's kind of silly, isn't it? That's almost like pretending that God has some kind of a queue system up there where he's like saying, I can only handle so much and yours is not important enough. But sometimes we feel that way. Like, is it that important? Does God even want to hear from me? After all, I'm a hot mess sometimes, you know? I don't think I'm worthy. He probably doesn't want to hear from me because I've not been very good or faithful. So probably I'm not on the welcome into the prayer room list. Or we don't feel worthy, or we feel our problem is too small, or we just feel maybe it's too late, it's too unfixable. And so these people could have said, I don't want to bother him. I don't matter that much. My situation is not important enough to him. This woman could have said, he's got more important places to go. This father could have said, there's no hope. But they tried anyway. And that's what I want to encourage you to do in your personal life today. What's that thing going on in your life? A bunch of you have come into this room today and you have something you're wrestling with, something that's going on in your world. I want to ask you a question. Are you troubled by it? Are you troubled by it? I don't even have to say what it is. Some of you know right now what I'm talking about. It's that thing that you go to bed thinking about when you go to bed at night, or stay awake thinking about, or wake up in the middle of the night or in the morning thinking about. It's that thing that you talk to your friends about, maybe overly talk to your friends about because you wear on others because you just can't help but be, you're troubled by it. What is that thing? Are you troubled by it? Here's what I want to encourage you to do today. Trouble God with it. You're like, yeah, Arlen, I know, but that's the point, isn't it? That I just feel like, I don't think I have the right, because, you know, it's me, and I don't think I'm that good of a, you know, God probably wants to hear from someone who's a better person or more faithful than me. Or maybe it's just not that big of a deal. Like, there's bigger problems in the world today, but this is your trouble. You troubled by it? Trouble God with it. I think it's too late, Arlen. I think that there's no point anymore. Hey, nothing's over until Jesus says it is. And when he does, that's when we move to the other part of faith that accepts his will. And that's a whole journey in itself. But right now, are you troubled by something? I'm asking you to trouble God with it. Because here's why. It's no trouble to him at all. It's no trouble. Peter, who, by the way, was in the story today as one of the three disciples in the room, Peter would later write a letter, and to his audience, he would write these words. He would say, cast all your cares upon him because he cares for you. And today, never let anyone, whether it's somebody else, the enemy, or your own self-doubt, convince you that you don't matter to God. If you're troubled by it, I hope you'll trouble God with it, because that's what he calls us to do.